Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Today we're going to share the experience of PJ from NDERF.org. That's the Near Death Experience Research Foundation website. And she has a short experience, but I think it's worth sharing. She says, I have fainted on numerous occasions, endured pain and loss of blood, have had several surgical procedures with nothing unusual to report, but there were two occasions when I did experience an out-of-body experience. They took place when the circumstances were, in my opinion, as described to me later, life-threatening or a trauma and shock to my system. In neither case was I prepared for what happened or even anticipated it. What happened was spontaneous. I would also like to add, for whatever it's worth, that I have always been very psychic, clairvoyant dreams for the most part, both before and after these experiences. I have always been spiritually minded. However, my out-of-body experiences were short-lived, and during them, I did not meet any spiritual beings or have any major soul revelations, at least that I recall, as has been reported by other people writing in. The first out-of-body experience. I am 17 years old and sitting in a classroom one warm fall afternoon listening to the teacher finish his lecture. I am also experiencing some monstrous menstrual cramps. I have fainted on occasion due to these, and I'm waiting for the class to end so I can get up and go to the nurse's office. There are only a few minutes left till the end of class, and if I can hold on, but I don't. I feel myself faint. But unlike other faints I've had before and since, this time I strike the side of my head on the metal rim of the desk in the row next to me as I fall off my seat. The next thing I know, I'm pulled out of my body from the back, like someone has yanked my soul out, painlessly but very abruptly, or my consciousness, who I am in other words, by the back of my neck. Without seeing where I'm going or headed, I find myself outside the school building, across the street from it, looking at it from what appears to be a position some dozen feet in the air, and somewhat to the left of the front of the school. I can see the second-story window of the classroom where I was, but I do not ask myself what has happened or why I'm suddenly where I find myself. I'm passive, but comfortable, and very aware of the colors and details of this ordinary landscape before me. Unlike a dream, this landscape reflects the type of day it was before I fainted. Sunny, blue skies, afternoon, local. One of the reasons I will never be convinced this was a dream. The colors are extra vivid. The sensation of being aware fully of this day and landscape, all-encompassing. I take in the scene all at once, not just what is before me, but around me and behind me. Then I'm aware of the class change bell ringing, and I observe students walking from one of the outlet school buildings toward the main building. The thing that I find curious about this is that as I focus on these students, I do not see them with the same sense of recognition that I did in regular awareness. Instead, a part of me, my vision, I think, telescopes right up to them, while the rest of me remains back at the same vantage point in the air. I'm aware of what each particular student that I focus on is thinking and feeling. In fact, I sense what it is to be that person. But I do not regard this information as I would in regular consciousness. I mean, at that age, had someone come to me and said you'll have the ability to know what someone else is thinking or feeling, I would have been downright gleeful, even mischievous about it. But at this point, for whatever reason, I am passive and at peace with what is going on, and there's certainly no desire to take advantage of or manipulate any situation. Then I'm suddenly sucked back towards the second story window, pulled in through the screen in a swoosh, at which point I lose my spirit sense and black out. I regain regular consciousness from where I am lying on the floor. I feel chilly and strange and slow, as if I had been out for a long while, even if I fell just a minute or so before. My body feels sluggish and heavy to me. The school bell had rung. Some of the students are filing out. Some of them are looking at me as they leave. A few are snickering. Later, I heard that some of them thought I fainted due to the heat in the room. My teacher and a friend or two of mine are helping me to my feet, asking me how I feel. One of them walks me to the nurse's office. What strikes me as so real about this experience, even after all these years, is the comfort and peace of it, as well as the vivid colors and sharp details of a landscape that I ordinarily would have taken for granted. No spiritual presences, though I have sensed them during other times. No bright lights or tunnels, but a clear, calm awareness, effortlessly achieved without effort on my part. The second out-of-body experience. It was quite similar to my first one. I stopped breathing during a difficult childbirth. The anesthesiologist clamped a gas mask over my face, and I lost consciousness. I don't know at what point it happened, but suddenly again, I was outside the hospital during the afternoon that my delivery is taking place, observing the traffic around the hospital, aware of intersections and the traffic, the partly cloudy sky, pedestrians walking into the hospital, every clear detail as clear as a bell, the same peaceful feeling. This out-of-body experience seems even more brief than the first one, though. I am not sure to this day how I know this, but I am sure of it. Then I'm back in the labor room, having just delivered a fortunately healthy baby boy. That's the end of the experience. Very interesting. I'm especially interested in what PJ said about when she's outside the school and she recognizes each of the students' thoughts and feelings as well as what it felt like to be that person. This isn't given in a lot of detail. Maybe a 2 on the detail scale, but that detail alone is very insightful. This idea that not only can she see and hear their thoughts, but she also knows what it's like to be them. And it's interesting that she says, but strangely, I didn't act or react to that ability as I might have in everyday life. She would have been like, whoa, you know, I'd maybe, you know, get somebody into trouble, or not trouble, she said mischievous is the word she used, probably look into the guy she likes to see if he likes her back or anything, you know, the way a 17-year-old might think. But she wasn't thinking that way. She had no desires, she said, to take advantage of or manipulate any situation. In fact, from the way she describes it, it doesn't sound like she's all that surprised. There may be a little bit of like, oh, that's what so-and-so's thinking, or that's what that person, it feels like to be that person, you know. There's a little bit I don't want to say surprise, but there's interest in the subject because she takes note of it, and she notices their thoughts and so forth, but she has no interest in using it for some selfish purpose. So very interesting. There is some kind of a balance between the spiritual mind and the mind under the physical body, because there's so much of what we think about in the physical that is very selfish, very egocentric, and so forth. And without the body, that tends to be dulled. Though the individuality of the person and their abilities, their true feelings about things all seems to be greatly enhanced. So, anyway, let's do another one. Same website, enderf.org. This is one by a girl named Gina. She says, during the car accident, I can remember feeling and sensing my body rolling with the car. I remember flying through the air and landing softly on the ground. and the whole time I felt like I was watching a movie. After I landed on the ground, I remember thinking that I should scream. So I screamed a slow, calm scream. I remember being in intensive care before the surgery, and a man of cloth, that's all I knew, as there was no face, just a presence, took my hand and told me I would be all right after I had surgery. When he took my hand, energy passed from him to me. I could feel it go through my whole body. I wouldn't let go of his hand, so he gently pried my hand off his. The next thing I knew, I was passing through a tunnel towards a very peaceful and beautiful bright light. I was met by moving forms that were pure energy. It was such a beautiful, loving place. I remember loving it there, and I am feeling astounded by the love that I was receiving. I reviewed my life, and I did the judging. I went back to when I was about 2 years old. I know I was given all types of information, but I don't remember just what it was. But sometimes I just know things, and I don't know how I know them. It's almost as if I have an additional sense. I had no choice but to return. I didn't want to, and I begged to stay. I was told that I had much to do before I could return. When I came back, there was an angel, a glowing bright light, at the foot of my bed. It stayed there as I recovered. As my health improved, the light faded and became more distant. I was very upset that I had to come back. In fact, I thought it was because I was such an awful person that even God didn't want me. I told no one of this experience until I was in my 30s after seeing an interview with James Moody. That's the end of the experience. Interesting. And for one thing, I find it interesting how she ends by saying, you know, I felt like even God didn't want me, you know, and whereas her experience itself seemed to magnify this idea or project this idea that God absolutely loves her and he's all loving and accepting and so forth. But then when she gets back in the body, she's faced with all the trials and pains of life. And then there's this man that appeared when she first was in the intensive care unit. A man of cloth, as she says, because there was no face, just a presence. That there's often a description of people, light beings, angels, whatever, that where they say, I couldn't make out a face, or maybe there was no face, or something like that. To us, that sounds a little creepy. But for one thing, many of them describe that facelessness as it's just that the brightness around their face is so bright that you couldn't see anything there, because it's kind of like if I stuck a, you know, 5,000 watt light bulb in front of my head. Do I have a face? Well, sure, but I can't look at it. It's too bright. You know, can't see anything there, whatever. And so there may be that, but also just this idea that it's not scary. They're not creeped out by these kinds of things. Actually, they're filled with love. So if you're worried about or discomforted by the idea of sometimes people having different things about their appearance than what you might expect, I wouldn't worry about that at all. Once you're in that state, you will not only accept the way they look, but actually find it, consider it probably their most beautiful, how they look most beautiful. Anyway, let's read one more. This is by Jackie on the same website. I was about 7 years old. I woke up feeling as if lead weights were on my stomach. I told my dad I felt sick to my stomach. After a few minutes, I sat up and vomited large quantities of blood. My dad helped me into the bathroom. It had been dark in my room, and he hadn't realized I'd thrown up blood until I threw up again. At that point, in the bathroom, I felt myself pass out. I remember I wasn't concerned about falling, I think because my dad was holding me up. Plus, I had never fainted before, so I didn't know what fainting was about. I remember a bit about the car ride to the hospital. Then I remember the nurses trying to get me to drink this grape-flavored stuff, barium, so that they could take an x-ray, but I kept gagging. They told me I was not allowed to throw the stuff up. I tried hard not to, while they kept pouring it down my throat, but I couldn't control the nausea, and again, I threw up a large amount of blood. I guess it was then that they realized my parents had not been exaggerating when they told them how much blood I had already vomited. They stopped trying to take an x-ray and forcing me to drink the grape stuff. I was aware of them running by my side while they were taking me down the hall on a gurney to another room. I woke up for a bit to see that the doctor had already stretched one arm out on a board of some sort and was inserting a needle into it. I turned a bit to see the same thing on the other arm. I remember the doctor was telling me something, maybe words of encouragement. The next thing I knew, I was floating above myself. I could see my parents on the other side of the curtain on the bed next to me. My mom was smoking a cigarette, and my dad looked very distressed, had his hands folded in his lap. I could sort of see myself, but mostly I was watching my parents, as a 7-year-old would. I don't remember having a body when I was above myself. I could see my body, but couldn't see the me who was above the scene, up in the air doing the looking. Then, every time after that, when I tried to open my eyes, it was grainy and noisy, just like when a cable goes out on your TV, same sound and visual. My first memory after that was being back in my body, waking up enough to know my mom was there. She told me if I lay quietly, she would read to me. I remember drifting in and out. I stayed in the hospital for a week. In my early 20s, when I was having an ulcer problem, I found out more about what had happened and why. They did an upper GI, which showed that my jugular vein was misshapen, probably due to the fact that I had always liked to sleep with my hand curled up under my chin. The doctor said he thought that years of sleeping like that, with the gentle pressure of my finger resting on my throat, had trained my jugular vein to bend in an abnormal position, a bit too close to my esophagus. This resulted in the piece of glass that I had swallowed nicking my jugular vein as it cut the inside of my throat. Another thing, several years later, I was telling my mom about my experience. She told me that soon after she lit the cigarette, the doctor yelled at her to put it out. But she kept smoking, ignoring the doctor, until a nurse said to her, "Put it out now, or leave. There are oxygen tanks present, and they could ignite." Then my mom put the cigarette out, but she was embarrassed, she said, that she was yelled at by a doctor, and that she had buckled under their pressure and put the cigarette out. She is very strong-willed. She also told me that the point at which she had lit the cigarette was when the doctor had ordered more blood. The nurse had said, "Do you want it stat?" And his response was, "Stat, heck! You run, and you run fast! She's already dead! But maybe we can bring her around if we get more blood into her quick enough." That's when my mom lit up her cigarette, she said. I said to my mom, "That's when I floated above myself, and I saw everything you just told me happen just the way you said it." We went on to corroborate other details of what I had seen. She was really scared and unnerved by this because we shared the same memories of what had happened, and that was the same point that the doctor had just told the nurse I was dead. That's the end of the experience. So another simple one in terms of content. Jackie goes up above her body and sees what's going on, but it's also one where it was validated years later when she's talking to her mom about it and talking about the little cigarette incident, both in the sense that, you know, she'd never talked to her mom about the cigarette incident, and her mom probably never talked to her about it, and she remembers it, as her mom said, and also that the doctor had confirmed in this, from her mom's perspective, that the doctor said that she's already dead, but that we can bring her around if we get more blood in her quick enough. So it's kind of not a wonder that people aren't told when they wake up so much, you know, we lost you for a bit there. You know, you stopped breathing or you stopped heart beating or whatever. Just because, I mean, there's people trying to sue hospitals all the time for trying hard to do their job and occasionally failing to bring somebody back to life, which is everybody at some point. So, I mean, it's not fair to sue a hospital for doing their best. But they worry about that, I think. And so a lot of times they won't mention that the person went as close to death, they got as close to death as they did. But that gives those who have near-death experiences opportunity to validate some of their experience and so forth. Even though it's certainly not necessary to have a full death in order to have a near-death experience, having a full death certainly adds, in most people's minds, validity to the claim. Anyway, so those three experiences are interesting. If you would like to share an experience, or if you would like to ask a question, make a comment, you can email neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com, or you can call our hotline, which is 970-NDE-CAST. And with that one, it will give you 3 minutes. And if you can't complete your experience or question in that time, just call back and continue as many times as it takes, and I will splice them together. You can also comment on the website itself, which is neardeathexperiencepodcast.org. And once again, thank you, all of you, so much for listening.